Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Today we are in Lesson 193. And last time at the end of the lesson, we were in Genesis 38 and in verse 18. At this point, Judah is negotiating with Tamar, his daughter-in-law, and of course he's not aware at all that she is, because she's pretending to be a harlot. And so she's negotiating with him the terms of the agreement that they were going to work out. That is, he wanted to go to her, obviously to have sex with her, and she was not going to let him do that without any payment, because that was customary. And so he had absolutely no money on him, and she asked him, "What are you going to give me as a pledge?" And so he said, "Well, I'll bring a kid of the goat from the flock." In other words, later on, I'm going to get it. And obviously, you know, there was no reason on his part there to cheat her, and she knew that, even though he didn't know her. And so she was not interested in that, because she was, in essence, plotting. She did it deliberately, since she could not have one of his sons, the third one, as a husband, and yet she wanted to have a son, a child, and therefore she, in essence, was plotting to actually have him fulfill the responsibility that one of his sons should have fulfilled toward her. One way or the other, she was going to do it. And obviously, she was not an Israelite. She was not of the family. She did not know God. She did not walk in his commandments. And so doing something like that, that did not matter too much for her. And this is what she said. Since she was plotting to do that, she said, "What kind of a pledge are you going to give me?" And obviously she was not interested in a kid, because that would not be a proof on her part. Because obviously she also realized, thinking through the whole matter, he's going to find out that she's pregnant. And according to the law that was practiced not only among the famous the neighboring countries, and still is to this very day in the Middle East, that if a matter like that happens within the family, the woman who is responsible for that, for prostituting herself, is going to be put to death either by her husband, if he's alive, or her brother, or somebody in the family. And she knew that Judah later on is going to deny the fact that he was the father. See, in those days they had no DNA, no kind of testing. And therefore she was plotting the whole thing. And so she wanted proof later on to prove to him and to the community that he is the father. And that was her way of going about this matter. And so she's asking me, "What kind of a pledge are you going to give me?" And he said, in other words, he asked her, "What kind of a pledge do you want?" Since she was not interested in the kid of the flock. And so he's asking her that, and she said, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." Now, those are very private items, and therefore any person who would show up with this kind of things, everybody would know they belonged to Judah, and there was no way for him to deny it. So he was pretty clever, pretty shrewd, and this was the mother, ironically, the mother of the Jewish people. And obviously, Judah was the father. And so you see here something about the background of the people of God, the one that God was going to choose to be the lawgiver, out of which tribe the Savior himself would come. So you can see that this element, in essence, was a part of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, and therefore many details have been recorded here that have to do with that. And so he gave them to her and came in unto her. That's a biblical terminology. And basically, even when it came to marriage, that's basically if a man wanted to have a wife, and anciently there was no such a thing as a marriage ceremony as we know it today in terms of the priest or the rabbi or a religious leader involved in that. They would have a marriage supper, not a marriage ceremony, as we know it today. Religious ceremony, that is. What they would have is, you know, certain cultural things that they've done, obviously. but it's not the common ceremony that we know today, be it religious or secular. And so basically the thing to do in that case, and that could be either before the community or that could be also privately. If a man, for example, goes to war and he finds a woman that he likes, as we read later on in the law in Deuteronomy, basically he has to do certain things, and then he comes in unto her and she becomes his wife. So by the mere act that a man goes into a woman, you see, they become one. And for that reason, later on, the Apostle Paul warned the Corinthians. He said, don't you know that he who goes to, in essence, to a woman, be it a harlot or anybody else, he becomes one flesh with her. In essence, that's how marriage takes place. So he told them that if they do not intend to be married to a certain woman, they should not go to any woman, period. Because if they do, first, they should be obligated to marry her, and since they can be, since she is a harlot, and they should not be doing that, because then it would be fornication. But if a man goes into a woman, if they have sex together, if they remain together, there would be no fornication involved there. But if they don't, in other words, if they went only for the purpose of having sex, that's when it becomes fornication. So this is what we see here. He went in unto her, and at this point, it became fornication in that sense. But on the other hand, since he went in unto her and he did not deny the fact that he went in unto her, and later on he took care of her, he had to take care of her because she was the mother of his children, and therefore it was sort of a marriage, but not a real marriage, since they did not have a relationship of a marriage. But you might say that it was sort of legal, semi-legal, whatever it may be, an awkward situation that was there. But she was known at that time, since that point, as a woman that was the woman of Judah. In other words, his wife, but not his wife in the real sense. But nevertheless, this was not a product of fornication in that sense, since he acknowledged her as the mother of his children, and she remained with him. Obviously, this is not the ideal, and there are some gray areas here. And so, that's what happened. He went in unto her, and she conceived by him, and she arose when that was over, and went away, and put off her veil from her, and put on the garments of her widowhood. And everybody in the community, and her parents, and everybody else knew her to be a widow, and therefore she went back to the normal life. And Judah sent the kid of the goats by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand. But he found her not. Then he asked the man of her place, saying, where is the harlot? Now, he did not use the word harlot, and the Bible does not use this word. He used the word kdesha. Now, what is a kdesha? Kdesha comes from the word in Hebrew, kadosh, which means holy or sacred. That's another word for holy. And basically what it was, those were the Canaanites. They had temples, they had rituals, and they had sacred prostitutes. And the whole thing involved a religious rite where men and women, based on their preference, as they went to the temple, they had the choice of going either to a woman or to a man. And they were called sacred. And in that manner, they thought that's how they honor and they worship their gods. Now, obviously, the religion was different than that of God. And so when he went into her, in essence, this is what he thought that she was. So Judah, on his part, was in essence really aware of the fact that he's committing fornication. You see? Because he was going to a sacred ones. So that tells you also about not only the desires, you know, the wrong desires on the part of Judah, but also a little bit about his religious background. He is not totally out of this way of life and culture and religious belief of the Canaanite. As we read earlier, when the children of Israel were asked by their father to give him all the gods, you know, that they worshipped. So there was a mixture there. of both the knowledge of God and idol worship. And that was a part of it here. And so he thinks that she was one of those temple prostitutes. And therefore, you know, that was legal in the society. Of course, it's not legal in the sight of God. Because since he's not going to marry her, he cannot go in unto her. And so he's asking, where is this harlot? Or where is the kedusha? And obviously, there was no such a thing. And they said, that is the people of the city, there has been no harlot here. In other words, they didn't have a temple there and didn't have any harlots there. And he returned to Judah and said, I have not found her. And also the men of the place said, there has been no harlot here. So these people did not have a temple prostitutes. And therefore, obviously, there was no such a person there. And Judah said, let her take it, lest we be put to shame. In other words, okay, that's the way it is, so let's keep it harsh. Otherwise, everybody's going to know that I went, because you see, if he went to Ekdesha, it's not a shame in the sight of the population. And probably, apparently, unfortunately, also, and tragically, even in the family of Jacob. You know, they understood that, since they were not totally out of idol worship, even though they were in the land. So that would not have been a shame to go to Ekdesha, or a harlot, but it would be a shame to go to a woman that is not. Because that would be a shame, fornication. And here is a man, and he's got a, you know, wife, married, and children. At least a hetshela. And so that would have been quite a shame on him. But if it was a kedusha, it would not have been. You can see the society in which Judah lived, and that's the way it was, unfortunately, for many centuries to come among the people of Israel. And we read in verse 22 that he returned to him, and this is what Judah said, let her take, in verse 23, let her take it, lest we be put to shame. Behold, I send this kid, and you have not found her. And it came to pass about 3 months after that it was told Judah, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. And moreover, behold, she is with child by harlotry. So not only she played the harlot, but she was pregnant. And now we see an interesting reaction on the part of Judah. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burnt. Now she's his daughter-in-law. She goes back to her parents. And you would think she's out of his jurisdiction in that sense. But that tells you a little bit about the laws there of the land. The father-in-law, who was the father of the sons that she was a wife to, had jurisdiction over the entirety of the family and therefore could pass judgment. So in those days, they didn't need to go to a lawyer and spend so much money and go to the judge. It was very simple. The family took care of these matters, and that was a custom long, long, long after that in the nation of Israel, where the father or the husband could handle these matters. And the state did not intervene. And as a matter of fact, in the Middle East, in some parts of the Middle East, to this very day, it's still the same. And even in Israel, a nation that is civilized, and they have laws, and they have judges, and obviously these kind of things are illegal. Yet when they happen among the Arab population there, you know, that live there, though they are Israelis, should be under the legal law. Generally, when that happens, when somebody shamed the family and her brothers or somebody in the family killed her, the law authorities generally try to cover their eyes, you know, pretend like it didn't happen, they didn't know anything about it. Understanding the biblical law and the cultural aspects that are there. And so this is basically the way it was in the old days. And so we read, that's exactly what Judah was going to do. He had the authority to do it within the community. And obviously, there was no legal system there. And if it was, it would not be contrary to it. But there was no legal system to come after him and accuse him of manslaughter or murder or whatever it may be. In the Old Testament, obviously, in that time, laws were different. And so people lived by this kind of laws. Today, you know, it would look like it's strange and horrible and evil. And, you know, obviously, if we judge it by our own standard, everything's going to look different. And verse 25, when she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, so while she was going, she was being brought, and obviously you can imagine the commotion there, they sent men after her, you know, his own people, his own servants, to bring her out. And she sends those things by one of the servants that obviously came to arrest her. And she says, you send it to Judah and tell him, by the man who is this, I am with child. And she said, discern, I pray you, whose are these, the signet and the cords and the stuff. And here you see an interesting reaction on the part of Judah. And Judah acknowledged him and said, she is more righteous than I. You see, he brought her out there to burn her, and then recognized that he was a guilty one, and so he acknowledged that in public. And so he was not a harsh man. He was not about to be deceitful and deny it and all things like that. He was caught, you know, red-handed, and obviously he was totally unaware of that, so, you know, that would have been something for his defense. But nevertheless, he had done it, and therefore he acknowledged it publicly. And so he said, for as much as I give her not to Shelah my son, that was the third one, and mind you, according to the laws of the land, he had to do it, you see, and therefore he was in the wrong. And so what she did, everybody would understand, was justified because of the fact that he was not willing to fulfill his part, and especially when he promised her that he would do it. And so Judah just did what every one of us should do when we are caught doing something wrong, not hide, you know, not pretend, not justify ourselves. Just be totally open about it, acknowledge our sin, and God generally has more mercy on people like that. And that's why we read later on in the Psalms a statement like that, that he that confesses and departs from the sin, in other words, forsakes it, doesn't do it anymore, he shall have mercy. And that's in essence what God wants us to do when we are in the wrong. Not to play games, not to justify ourselves, not to hide, not to twist matters, and you know, whatever it may be. And that's human nature. Just come out in the open, totally acknowledge your sin, and then obviously, God is going to punish you anyway, and one way or the other, for what you have done, depending on the severity of it, but He's going to also have mercy on you. That case, a classical case, everybody knows about it, in the case of David, and what he did, and when he acknowledged it in the open, as wrong as he was, though God punished him for it, not only the child was taken away from him, but the sword was in his house until the day he died. And that's what God said He's going to bring upon him because of him being a righteous man, a prophet, a leader in Israel, and I was, in essence, giving God a black eye. And God could not allow him to get away with nothing. In this case, he was not in Judah, and so it was a different thing. Yeah. And so the punishment is not mentioned there, but the shame obviously remained there. And he had to remain with her, and he had to stay with her. You know, he had to take care of her, that is, care for her needs. And she, in essence, became his wife. And that was also a part of the law. You know, you went to a woman, and you had sex with her, she had children. That's your business now. You better take care of her. And so she was in this gray area of sort of his wife, but not having a relationship with him. Nevertheless, he was acknowledged as the father, and he had to acknowledge that and take care of her. And so this is what we read here. And he said, he acknowledged his sin, and he said, she's more righteous than I, for as much as I give her not to Shelah my son. And he knew her again no more. Now, what does that mean, he knew her again no more? Obviously, he was not going to have a relationship with her, a sexual relationship with her. But also it tells you that she had to remain there, and she was known to be as his wife, but he just would not have any sexual relationship with her anymore. And you read the same case also with David. David had a wife. Her name was Michal. She was the daughter of Michael, daughter of King Saul. And then when he had to flee from Saul, she was taken away from him, though she was his wife, legally his wife. Everybody knew it, and Saul took her, and in essence, contrary to the law, he took her and gave her to somebody else. Yet she was still married legally in the sight of the law to David. And so now she's married, she has children, and when David becomes king, he wants her back. That was one condition that he put before Abner for reconciliation, and she comes back to him, that is, you know, in essence, forcefully, they force her to come back to him, and you know, shoo away the husband who went after her, and you can read that account in First Samuel. And then, later on, we read the story that when David brought the ark into the temple, that is, into Jerusalem, she was mocking him because she saw him dancing. And then he told her at that point that, you know, he was extremely displeased at her, and he was going to serve God no matter what. And he was so angry at her, and though she is his wife, she is with him. It says about her that he, from that time on, he knew her no more. So everybody still knows she is his wife, but he's not fulfilling this obligation because of her attitude. And in this case, we find the same. You know, she's by law, because he had sex with her, and she was not married, so it's not adultery, it's not fornication, if he takes her and takes care of her. It would be if he does not. And so he takes her and takes care of her, she becomes the mother of his children, and his wife in that sense, whether he likes it or not, he has to take care of her, but he's not having relationship with her. So, you know, that tells you, shows you a little bit about the culture at the time. And also, in spite of certain things, when they happen, the law one way or the other has to be upheld. And even in the Canaanite societies, they have certain laws that were pretty similar to the laws of God. In other words, God wants man to be responsible, or a woman, for her action or his actions. And therefore, they have to still do certain things depending on the circumstances. At least fulfill the responsibility. Nobody gets scot-free, you know, with nothing. And so now she's pregnant, and she's having the children, and God is recording something very interesting, because that has to do an awful lot with the nature of the people that God chose to be the people of the scepter and the lawgiver, the people of Judah. And the qualities and traits that are in Judah are going to be manifested here in this childbirth. Verse 27, and it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And it's very interesting, because Judah is the son of a father, Jacob, who himself was one of the twins, he and Esau. And the twins are so different from each other. And you see quite a few twins there in the history of the people of God. And so there were twins here, and they were in her womb. And it came to pass, when she traveled, that one put out a hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying. Now, they all knew that there were twins, and so how are you going to determine who is the firstborn? If he just comes, the first one comes out, it's no problem, you know, he's the firstborn. But since babies look alike, they made sure that they would not get mixed up, and that's what they did. That was a part of the custom. It's nothing, was nothing unique here, what she did here. And therefore, it became a reality later on in the history of these two sons of Judah. From Tamar, that is, from his daughter-in-law, that now becomes his wife. And so she put the scarlet on his hand, and the midwife took and bound his hand scarlet thread, that is, upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this came out first. And it came to pass, as he drew back his hand, now why would that happen? We don't know. All we know is that God is in charge of matters here, and God is obviously here doing something, because that's extremely uncommon for a baby to come out, you know, put his hand forth, and just go back. Something very unusual here. Just like, you know, in the case of Jacob and Esau. It was very unusual the way it happened before they were born, not at the time of birth. And then again, you see the involvement of God there, because what happened here, in essence, determined history for many generations to come for this too. And so, that's what happened here. She said, this came first, and it came to pass, as he drew back his hand, in verse 29, that behold, his brother came out, And in Hebrew, the word came out is burst out, you see. And that's what she called him, in essence. And so she said, wherefore have you made a breach for yourself? You know, in Hebrew it's peretz, see. And peretz, that means you know, just like somebody invades a house or invades a city, you see. And as a matter of fact, in Hebrew, the very name for a thief and a robber that bursts into a house and steals is called poretz. It comes from that. So she said, why did you burst, or in English here, wherefore have you made a breach for yourself? Therefore, his name was called Peretz. And obviously, if you don't know Hebrew, you know, you don't see any link there, any connection. And when you read it in the Hebrew, she said to him, I'll read it in Hebrew, Ma paratzta, why have you burst forth? So she said, Ma paratzta alecha Peretz. In other words, why have you burst forth like, you know, like a thief, you know, that bursts into a place? So she said, Ma paratzta Peretz, and so she called his name Peretz, or Peretz. And one that burst forth, and that became a major trait of the Jewish people. They're not the kind of people that come very gently and softly, you know, they're just, they're pushy in essence. It's a pushy kind of a quality. And that's how they came out. They came out that way, from the beginning of life. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Zerah means shining. And she gave him that name for a reason. He's not the person that, in other words, when the sun comes out in the morning, you know, you see gently, you know, a little rays of sun and then light, and then the sun comes out, you see, in a different way. Peretz didn't come out that way, you know. The sun doesn't just come out that way, you know, it's sort of a gentle thing, something that happens gradually. And so she was making a difference between these two. One comes out like the sun, and one just bursts out. And there he is. And technically now there is a problem, you know, his hand, but he's not born, you know, when you just put out your hand. So he's the firstborn on one hand, because he put out his hand, but he's not the firstborn in the sense that he came out first, because Judah then now takes his place. Judah is the one that comes out first, so he becomes the firstborn. So you see, that created, later on in life, when the scepter was an issue, that created, obviously, major problems between these two, just like it did between Jacob and Esau. That's very interesting. You know, there is a repetition in the second generation of the family of Jacob, or the family of Isaac, where his sons come out that way, and then his grandsons also come out that way, in this case. And yet God is using all that for his own purpose. And later on, these items that you read in this chapter played major role, at least played a role in the history of these two. And that's from the, you know, when you study the history of the people of Zerah, as they went into, as we know, into Scotland and Ireland, and Northern Ireland, you know, they still maintained, you know, those symbols, all the birthright of their father. And obviously, as time goes by, they don't know where they came from, but they just preserve them. And when you study the history of these people, you find this very symbols here. You know, the thread, you know, the red scar, you know, the thread, and the palm, and the hand, and things like that, because his hand came out first. And these were, in essence, indications and clues to the identity of the people of the brother of Peretz, of the Jewish people. Of course, the others were not the you know, the others are also Jews in the sense that they are children of Judah, but they became known as just the children of Zerah, not the people of the people of Judah, because they did not, basically, most of them did not reside with the house of Judah. They just departed, and so as time went by, obviously they changed their name. They are known by different names today. So that, you know, this gives you not only a history of what happened long time ago, but also the way God used it, and also the impact that it had on the future history of these two twins. And so here, the inset chapter, in a sense, of what's happening in the meantime, is given here, and that's what we just read. And then God decides to go back to the story of Joseph now. And basically now he's going to devote much of the rest of the book to Joseph, and then also later on his brothers and his father. And so we're in chapter 39, the history of Joseph as he was brought back to, that he's brought down to Egypt. In verse 1, and Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, as we mentioned earlier, Potiphar means, comes from the word Ra, which was the king, the sun king. And so this guy was named after this god. And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's, the captain of the guard, in essence is one of his generals, an Egyptian, bought him. So he was an Egyptian, and the reason why it's mentioned in Egyptian, because not everybody was an Egyptian in the elite. In other words, when we study history, we realize that the Hyksos, in other words, some people invaded Egypt and took over, and that was during the days of Joseph. And then when they were overthrown by the native Egyptians later on, we read the story with the children of Israel. And there arose a king after Joseph that did not know Joseph, you know, and all the things that he had done, and he's the one that persecuted the children of Israel. And so that's the reason, you know, you also find here. In other words, God does not just inject words for nothing. There is always a reason for every word that you read in the Bible. And so when he says that he was an Egyptian, that means he was not from that invading foreign people that took over the throne of Egypt. And so this guy was an Egyptian, and he bought him of the hand of the Ishmaelites, even though the Midianites also were involved. In one place we read the Midianites are the ones that saw him in the pit and they sold him to the Ishmaelites. Another place we read that the Midianites brought him to Egypt, but actually it was the Ishmaelites. And he read again, it was the Ishmaelites. But obviously, since the Midianites were involved, therefore their name appears again there, as we read that earlier. And so he bought it from the Ishmaelites that had brought him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph. And he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Obviously, Joseph's having a relationship with God, but Joseph also, even though God has great plans for him, Joseph also is at a time, that is before he was sold, where he needs to learn some lessons. That with God, when God gives us a mighty blessing, whatever it may be, we can never use that blessing as a reason to be arrogant or haughty or self-exalting and abasing of others. And that's unfortunately what happens to many who rise to the top. They're given positions, they're given authority, sometimes even not way to the top, just beginning to rise up. And immediately, unfortunately, when they're given to human nature instead of to the nature of God, they allow that spirit of self-exaltation and haughtiness and arrogance, and God abhors that. And though he's not necessarily going to remove the blessing that he gave to a certain person, he's going to teach them lessons to constantly humble themselves before the mighty God, that he will exalt them and not that they would exalt themselves. And so this is what Joseph has to go through here, and yet God is still with him, because basically he had many good things that God liked in him. And so he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did prosper. Now, mind you, the Egyptians also, though they did not worship, you know, the God of Jacob, as Jacob did, as Abraham did, as Isaac did, nevertheless, they are aware of the fact that there is that Elohim, the Elohim of the Hebrews. It was not something that was hidden in the corner at the time, and that was the nature of idol worship. They knew there is a God of gods, Elohim, the supreme being, and also they have the other deities. And so he's aware of the God of Joseph, of the Eternal, of Jehovah. And therefore he reacts accordingly. And so we read in verse 4, and Joseph found favor in his sight, and he ministered unto him. In other words, he was his personal servant, not just a general one, you know, working in the fields. But he took care of special needs of the master. He raised him to that position of a close servant and advisor, and he ministered unto him, and he appointed him over, that is, an overseer over his house. So he's a chief of staff now. He is rising to the top. And all that he had, he put into his hand. And it came to pass, from the time that he appointed him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And that, in essence, was a part of the promise that God made to Abraham. Those who bless you, you see, those who treat you well, will be blessed. And those who do not, those who curse you, will be cursed. And so you see here exactly what happens. And basically that's what happened also with the children of Israel, wherever, you know, they went in terms of the captivity, and then other lands when they were freed from bondage, you know, the Assyrians, wherever they went. And even here in Egypt, later on, as they multiply into a family, when they came down to Egypt, wherever they go, those who treat them nice and well are also being blessed by the blessings that God pours upon his people Israel. And so that became also one of the indications to recognize when does a people get blessed. And wherever the children of Israel were, oftentimes you would see that the places that are blessed upon the face of the earth are the places where the children of Israel have arrived. And in their blessings, the natives also are being blessed. And that works to this very day. And so, that's what God is doing for this man. It's not just an individual thing. That was a part of the covenant that he made with the fathers. And the nations of the earth that have recognized that, they preferred to live in peace with the people of Israel so they can be blessed also with their blessings. That was sort of the back door that they had to come to God, through Israel. And that became a part of the way in the process of salvation and redemption for all mankind, for all humanity, to come to God through Israel. There is no other way. In the New Testament, you see abundance of that, even though some people have forgotten that because they've developed a theology that is foreign to God and to his religion, and so they like to remove this part of the equation of the redemption out of the way and think that they can have a direct relationship with God apart from Israel. And yet Paul made it very plain that you, he's speaking to the Ephesians, and he said it in different ways to other people that God was calling, grafting among the Gentiles. He said that in the days of old, in time past, since you were not members of the people of Israel, you were basically people without hope, without salvation, without redemption, without covenants, without promises, you see. But now that when God grafted you into the commonwealth of Israel, you see, now you can have both physical and spiritual blessings. And the emphasis was there, obviously, on the spiritual, but also, with the spiritual, God also gives the physical blessings. And so it is, and so it was, and that's the way God determined that from the time he called Abraham. That's the way he was going to bless all nations of the earth. And so he told him, in your seed be Jesus Christ, who himself was speaking to him and blessing him, and also in his physical descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So here you see an example of that. And verse 6, we read, and he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and having him, he knew not note or anything save the bread which he did eat. In other words, once he gave it to him, he knew that he is a trusted man, God is with him, he didn't worry about anything else. And Joseph was beautiful of beautiful form, in other words, he was good looking and fair to look upon. And unfortunately, sometimes beauty, either for a man or a woman, or good looking, or good looks, creates a problem. And so it is here, in verse 7, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Now, some people, as they study this matter, they realize that this woman is a young woman. Potiphar doesn't seem to have children, and he probably was an old man, an older man, and so that was classical reality there, unfortunately and tragically. And this is what was happening here. But he refused. He's a young man, she's a young woman, and nevertheless, she has no morals, he does, and so there is a clash here. And in essence, God is also allowing this test here to come upon him. So he's using all this circumstances to try and test his own people. And that happens in many ways. And yet, nevertheless, God promises us he's not going to allow us to be tested more than we can handle. And that's the way he develops his nature in us also. So he refused. He obeyed God rather than man. And said unto his master's wife, "Behold, my master, having me, knows not what is in the house. And he has put all that he has into my hand." And obviously, you are not one of them. "And he is not, that is, he is not greater in this house than I." In other words, he left me everything. And we're sort of on an equal basis. I am in a position as if I owned everything. And that's the kind of trust that I have from him. And so it says, he is not even greater in this sense. Whatever I do, you know, it's okay with him. And of course, there is one exception. And he says, "Neither has he kept back anything from me but thee, because you are his wife." In other words, everything else, in terms of property and riches and servants and everything else, was under my control, absolute control. He gave me absolute trust, and I'm not going to repay him with evil. So, obviously, she's not thinking about any of that. You know, this kind of logic is nonsense to her. She just wants something, and that's all there is to it. And so he's adding something else beside that trust to his master. He says, "How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against Elohim?" Now, she too is aware of Elohim, because she's not asking him, "Who is that Elohim you're talking about?" And so he's appealing now to the highest authority to let her realize that even if he was not afraid of the master, there is a higher authority that he's obedient to. And so he certainly is doing here what the Apostle Paul at would say, "Whatever you do in word or in deed, do it as unto the Lord." You see? In other words, our actions, our thoughts, our feelings, or as Paul would put it in other words in 2 Corinthians, that we have to come to the point where we subjugate every thought, you see, every attitude, every feeling, everything that we do has to come under the authority of Christ, under subjection to Christ, and pulling down every other thing that opposes God. And that's exactly what he does, and that's a wonderful example for us. So he's learning good lessons here. And so far, God has been with him, and he's going to pass the test. And so, we read in verse 10, "And it came to pass, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her." So temptation here was not too strong for him to resist. And obviously, the trust that he had toward his master, the trust that his master had for him, and his fear of God, these two made it possible for him to overcome it. And oftentimes, when people commit either fornication, you know, with somebody's neighbor or friend or whatever it may be, they don't think about their neighbor, they don't think about his feelings, they don't think about the end results, they don't think about the children, you see. So they don't think about that part of the equation, the human element, and they certainly don't think about God. And when we think about this too, that gives us strength to overcome a temptation. And oftentimes the temptation is done thoughtlessly. You know, we're just given to our feelings and emotions and we block out everything else. And so when God does not allow us to be tempted more than we can handle, it is up to us to handle the human element, and also to remember the fear of God. And obviously, if we don't have either one of them, we're going to succumb to the temptation. Joseph was not about to do it. And this is what he's saying here. "As much as she was trying to do it day by day, but he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her." You know, the flee temptation principle. And that's what happens also. We're given to temptation oftentimes because we just sort of play with it, thinking, "Well, I'm strong enough." Well, we don't realize that the mere fact that we're playing with it, we're already giving in. And so the devil has a way there, and that's exactly what he did with Mother Eve. She should have known better not to even talk to him. But when she was willing to listen to him, just like, you know, a person, you're willing to listen to the salesperson, sooner or later he's going to break down your defenses and penetrate and weaken you, and then cause you to give in. And then you buy the product you know you have no interest for. And so in verse 11, and it came to pass on a certain day, when he went into the house to do his work, and there was none of the men of the house there within. Obviously, she was plotting, and she planned the whole thing. So there would be no witnesses. And this time she was going to really force it on him. And maybe she thought also, because there are some people around, he's afraid to get caught, but, you know, otherwise he may not. In either case, she planned everything. In other words, the devil was out there for the kill. And mind you, Satan knows that God is working with this man. This is a man of God, a servant of God. His demons know that. And so they're going to give wisdom to their children on this earth, you know, the wisdom that is devilish, to plot all kind of things in order to trap the people of God. Anyway, we're going to stop at this point, and again, this is Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.